Support for Science Friday comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The reports from the fifth gathering of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change are in. And these reports say climate change is visible on every continent and in every ocean. It's pushing species into different habitats, shrinking glaciers, and melting permafrost. And if you thought we were headed in the right direction on emissions, greenhouse gas emissions actually grew 2.2% a year in the last decade, five times as fast as they did in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And yes, there is a very real human impact, because scientists say we're seeing more people die in heat waves as a result of warming, and crop yields for staples like wheat and corn are already on the decline due to climate change, and it's forecast to get worse. Add to that the growing world population, expected to hit 9 billion by 2050, and countries like China eating more resource-intensive meat than ever, and you come to the conclusion that we might be eating our way into a problem. Where are we going to get all this food? How are we going to do it sustainably without contributing to climate change even more? That's what we're going to be talking about. Let me introduce my guest. Jonathan Foley is director of the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota in St. Paul. He has a cover story out in National Geographic this month on the future of food. He joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Foley.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
You're welcome. Catherine Hayhoe is associate professor and director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas. May also have seen her on TV starring in James Cameron's new climate series, Years of Living Dangerously. She joins us from KTTZ today. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Hayhoe.
Thanks for having me.
Let me begin with you, Dr. Hayhoe. What do these latest climate reports tell us that we already didn't know?
Well, a lot of it is what we already did know. Climate is changing. It's because of human activities, and it matters because it's impacting our lives today. What's new, though, is the fact that we are actually seeing many of these impacts now with our own eyes. It used to be that climate change was an issue that was distant in space, you know, talking about the polar bear, or in time, something that would affect our children. But what the IPCC reports make very clear is that the impacts are here today.
They are. Let's talk about, John Foley, what sort of impact, for example, does agriculture? What is climate change? How is that impacting agriculture?
Well, the IPCC and other recent analysis of this have been showing that, yes, in fact, climate change is right here, right now, and it is taking a bite out of our agricultural production. While there's still increases in global food production each year, we are still going up. It's going up at a smaller rate than we otherwise would see, according to the IPCC and all the underlying science behind that. And it's happening, of course, at just the wrong time. As population and diets and affluence continue to grow around the world, we need to grow more food and deliver more nutrition to the world, not less. And so climate change is really eating into our ability to feed the future.
And conversely, growing crops, agriculture, is having an effect on climate change.
Oh, yes, absolutely. We usually think of climate change as a problem of our automobiles and power plants and our energy sector. But it turns out that all of our burning of fossil fuels is about 60% of the global warming problem. About 30% of it actually comes from agriculture. And of that 30%, most of that is from deforestation, kind of, you know, cutting down tropical rainforest and burning all of that wood and leaves, which is carbon, burning that stuff, adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. Or methane, another powerful greenhouse gas coming from cattle when they burp, mostly, not the other end, and also from rice fields that release methane. And third is a very powerful greenhouse gas called nitrous oxide, or N2O, which when we over-fertilize our agricultural fields under certain conditions, nitrous oxide can leak out of the soil. So those three things, deforestation, cattle and rice, and nitrous oxide from over-fertilized regions, are adding about 30% of all the climate-changing gases into the atmosphere we add every year. And that's twice as much as all of the transportation in the world, which is only 15%. So if you want to tackle climate change, I would argue you start with agriculture and, of course, energy.
You were in Brazil recently and say they've done a good job of reducing deforestation.
Yeah, actually, this is one of the few bright spots. As you pointed out, Ira, you know, our emissions are overall globally going up. But Brazil, interestingly, has cut their emissions, especially due to deforestation. The rates of deforestation in Brazil have dropped almost 70% to 80% over the last 6 to 8 years, which is extraordinary. Nobody thought that was going to be possible, but it happened. Mm-hmm. And people are seriously talking about having no deforestation in Brazil by maybe 2020, 2025.
Really? You mean no burning of the rainforests? Things like that?
Well, people are hedging this, saying maybe no net deforestation, clearing it in one place, but then replanting it in another. So, you know, those details will matter a lot. But it's an extraordinary win. I mean, what Brazil has already done would be like taking every car off the road in the United States and turning them off forever. Hmm. That's extraordinary. We haven't done that.
Wow.
And we need to do far more. Now the attention needs to shift in deforestation to places like Indonesia and Malaysia, where there's still very high rates of clearing. But Brazil is a sign of hope, and it's good.
Hmm. Catherine Hayhoe, I don't have to tell you, living in West Texas, that the wells are drying up throughout the plains. How much of this has to do with climate change, and how much with just maybe overpumping? Can we actually point to climate change and say, now we know this is proof?
Mm-hmm. Well, what's happening is we always have these natural cycles of wet and dry and hot and cold all around the world. But today, climate change is interacting with those natural cycles. So when we get a drought, just like we had in the 1950s and very famously in the 1930s Dust Bowl, nowadays that drought is warmer than it would be otherwise. That means more water is evaporating, and farmers need more water to irrigate their crops than they would otherwise. So that's why our aquifer is drying up, is because we've got this massive agricultural system in a semi-arid desert environment, and we're pulling this fossil water out of the ground faster and faster to water our crops, and the hotter it gets, the more of that water we need. The only problem is it's a finite resource.
Mm-hmm. Are people able to connect the dots in their own minds? I mean, have people changed their mind that they believe in global warming, climate change, and willing to make those connect those dots with the change in the weather that they're seeing now?
That's an interesting question. I think that things have definitely changed here the last few years. If I went out and talked to farmers and ranchers here 3 or 4 years ago, as I have, they would say, you know, this is just the same drought that my daddy saw and my granddaddy saw and even my great-granddaddy saw back in the 1800s. But today people are getting to the point where they're starting to realize and they're starting to be ready to admit something's different. They may not be willing to admit that it's actually people who are changing the world's climate, but they're starting to realize it's different. And that's the first step, because in order to adapt to these changes, honestly, often we don't have to agree on the cause. We just have to agree on the reality of the problem.
John, you agree?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I live in Minnesota, and we just experienced one of the worst winters in 40 years. And, you know, there's the kind of disconnect of telling people, yes, you know, weather still happens. And just because it's cold outside right now doesn't mean global warming isn't real. But people are noticing things are changing. Overall, our springs are happening earlier. The snow's moving further north. The moose are dying away from Minnesota and up through New England. And yeah, I mean, I think everybody's noticing something is changing. And just what the IPCC is saying, it's showing up now. Mm-hmm. And people see it.
I was just reading.
And in fact,
go ahead.
Sorry, one of the reasons why this winter seems so cold is because we actually hadn't had a really cold winter in nearly two decades.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I was just reading a report put out by the Population Reference Bureau that said that by the year 2050, Africa's population is likely to grow by 1.3 billion people, the largest growth of any region in the world, including Asia, which currently has about 60% of the people on the planet. It's the poorest region, and it's going to be growing at the fastest rate. Where are we going to get all the food to feed all these people?
Well, that's a huge challenge. I mean, what we're seeing here, Ira, is really kind of the perfect storm. We have continued population growth. We especially in the places that can stand it the least, like a lot of sub-Saharan Africa, with very bad kind of resources, economic conditions, and governance. This is a tough part of the world, and it's experiencing the biggest stress. And then we have climate change, and then we have also increasing wealth in many parts of the world, which are consuming more and more of the world's resources. You put all that together, it's really a terrible storm we're brewing. Mm-hmm. And what's but we can't point to population and say that's the only thing. I think it's a little too easy for Americans to do that because we're part of this too, even regions that aren't growing population very much, like the U.S. and Europe and Japan. As you think about it, we're 7 billion people now, roughly. We're talking as a whole, the world growing to about 9 billion by 2050. That's a 28% increase if you do the math, 2 billion out of 7. But if you look at what we're projecting for food demand globally, it's going to be much, much more than that. It might be 80, 90, 100% more food, a doubling. And that's because there are 3 to 4 billion people in the world right now in China and India, Brazil, and other places who are getting richer. And as people have gotten richer in the past, especially the recent past, they get richer diets. They look to the European diet or, God forbid, the American diet and want to eat more like us. So it's going to be a complex story. Population growth will be dominating Africa, but affluence and changing diets are going to dominate in Asia in the coming decades, and both are going to strain the world food system.
Mm-hmm. I have about a minute to the break, but we're all very fearful that we've reached a tipping point, right? That it's going to tip over, and there's really not much we can do about it. Better get used to it.
I don't subscribe to that. I don't know about Catherine. Yes,
no.
Of course the world is complicated and hard, but any moment in history worth living in has been challenging. And we have more, I don't know, I'm a glasses half full kind of guy. Mm-hmm. I think we have more opportunities and more innovation, and we know more than not only any generation in history. We know more and can do more than all previous generations combined. So this is a big challenge, but I'm actually quite hopeful that we'll rise to the occasion and make this happen and make it work.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to come back. Catherine, I'll get your take on it when we come back after this break. We're going to have to take a break. We're talking with Catherine Hayhoe, Associate Professor and Director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University, and also Jonathan Foley, Director of the Institute of the Environment and University of Minnesota in St. Paul. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll take your calls, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about climate change and the future of food with my guest, Jonathan Foley, Director of the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota in St. Paul, Catherine Hayhoe, Associate Professor and Director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas. Our number, 844-724-8255. Recognizing that we are in climate change and global warming is happening and we're having to have more droughts, changes in the weather happening, do we need a new green revolution for the food? I mean, or are there other, do we need to find a different way of farming, different way of making crops, different kinds of crops, drought resistant, things like that?
All of the above?
All of the above. And are people actively doing that now?
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's really interesting, though, is that we, for the last 40 years, we've been kind of, well, you remember a few years ago, like Sarah Palin and others would yell, drill, baby, drill as their energy policy. Well, I think we've had a kind of a quiet grow, baby, grow kind of policy for agriculture for a long time. We'll just grow more. We'll grow more. And that's served us pretty well for a long time. But now we're going to have to do things like use what we already grow smarter. So I'm a big fan of thinking about how do we reduce food waste? We throw away about 30 to 50% of all the food grown on Earth. That's a huge opportunity. That could go a long way to feeding the future. And also thinking about our diets, how much meat we eat and dairy products, and whether we use food crops as biofuels, all those kinds of things are kind of on the demand side of the equation as well on the supply side where we grow more. Mm-hmm. I think we'll need to do a little bit of all that.
Yeah. Catherine, you want to add something?
Yeah, I would just add that many of these solutions are not just for the purpose of climate change. They're for the purpose of building a more long-term sustainable society, improving our own health, improving the quality of what we eat. It's a win-win-win. It's not just about one issue.
Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about rain shortages, droughts, things like that, and you think about when we plant food to feed animals. It takes a lot of water to grow what we feed the animals, and then a lot of times we're shipping some of that agriculture overseas to feed other people's animals who are eating more meat that are going to use up more resources. It's sort of like we're solving somebody else's problem but using our own water that we're taking from something else that could benefit from it.
I think the solutions here are really about doing things smarter, and as John said, we have the ability to do that.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean, eating less meat? Because that's very water and product intensive? Or is it, what does it mean doing smarter in your words, Catherine?
In my words, certain types of meat like beef obviously take up much more resources than other types of meat like chicken. In my own house, I know that we throw away way too much food, and I've been making a really conscious effort to try to plan ahead better so that we don't waste that food. And that, as John said, is some of our biggest issues, is just that we are used to this consumer-based society, whereas in reality, we have to realize that we all need food, and it's hard to get more of it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Scott in Palo Alto. Hi, Scott. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there. My daughters and I just built what's called an aquaponics system, where you marry the growing of fish together with the growing of vegetables, and you can grow the vegetables on grass that float in water or just in gravel. But it's known for being highly efficient as far as water conservation goes, and also growth rate of vegetables. I was wondering if your guests had heard about those types of systems, and if they were aware of kind of the do-it-yourself communities online it's kind of taking off right now. We see a big project in Santa Cruz and in Half Moon Bay that's going in now. It's probably not profitable yet, but as climate change can be considered a market force, I think it'll be kind of a decentralized agricultural system in the future.
Mm-hmm. John, you have any reaction to that?
Oh, yeah, certainly. That's become aquaponics is, again, growing fish and vegetables and things like that together, let's say in a warehouse or some indoor space. They're happening all over the place. Even in St. Paul, where I live, there's an old brewery turning into one of these things, which is pretty cool. But I have a little concern about that, though. I mean, for growing vegetables and fresh greens, things we want local and fresh and timely, that could be a very cool solution, and maybe for the fish as well. But to grow things like the world's rice production or wheat or these huge cereals, I don't see how we're going to make the math add up. We cover right now about 40% of all the land on Earth is used to grow food. Cities, every city and suburb in the world added together is about 1%. So even if we had aquaponics growing in every single rooftop and all of our warehouses and all that, it's not going to make a big dent in the big crops like cereals. But as a supplement, as a way of getting fresh things in the city sustainably and better, that could be cool. But whether it's profitable and it's very capital intensive, those are remaining questions. But we need this kind of innovation. We need to try everything and see what works. So I love this kind of innovation. I think it could be great.
How much of our food do we ship or overseas that might stay home and help us here in the States? And how much of the feed grain we make or the stuff we would feed animals do we ship overseas? And would that make a difference if we kept it here?
Well, that makes a big difference. But it's not just what we keep here or ship abroad. It's also what we choose to grow in the first place. Like the Midwestern U.S. where I live, most of the crops, if you drive through, from Pennsylvania to Colorado, the first thing you'll notice driving that whole way is basically corn. Well, in the U.S., that corn is not consumed by people. That corn and soybeans that you see through the Midwest is mainly animal feed and increasingly used for ethanol. In Minnesota, for example, about 90% of all the farmland we have is used to feed non-people, animals and cars. It turns out the Midwest could feed about 16 people per hectare of land if we were all vegetarians and we didn't make biofuels. But what we make right now is about 5 people's worth of food per hectare. That's about the same as Bangladesh grows right now. So it isn't just what we grow, it's what we choose to use it for. And we like animal products in America, and we like ethanol policy in America right now. So those are dominating agriculture, but we could triple the amount of calories grown in the Midwest, for example, right now by switching our diets and biofuel policies. Mm-hmm. But we've chosen not to do that as a country. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of latitude right there.
Yeah. Catherine, you talked about what is good for climate change is also just good policy in general for the Earth. You mentioned that before. And I bring that up because I noticed recently that Texas is the number one state for wind power. And do you think more and more people and businesses are making smart choices for the environment, not because of climate change, because of dollars and cents? For example, in Texas, I read that 2 weeks ago, Texas smashed the record for most wind energy ever generated. 38% at one point during some day, 38% of all the energy came from wind power in Texas. That's just
right.
Amazing number.
And the record they smashed had been set just the previous week.
Huh.
No, that is exactly what we see happening here. These wind turbines are going up on the land of farmers and ranchers who couldn't care less about climate change. They're doing it because it just makes sense. Mm-hmm. We had an electrician in our house just the other day who said that they're out of LED lights because they're putting them in so many houses around town that they can't keep them in stock, not because of climate change, just because they make sense. There are a lot of win-win-win solutions that would make our lives better, that would save us money, that would improve the quality of the food that we eat, and they would also go a long way towards helping with climate change and with long-term sustainability, not just of the planet, but of people.
So it looks like people, the grassroots up is the way that it's moving. People are making their own choices.
Mm-hmm.
Well, or also businesses, too. Just adding to that, what Catherine's saying is absolutely right. I mean, it makes just good economic sense in many cases. But a lot of companies and governments and NGOs and militaries around the world are seeing climate change and these other issues like population growth and what happens to food and water supplies as a kind of a security risk or right. a risk to finance or to commodity prices or, you know, a risk in general to business. And if anything, business leaders are very risk averse. They don't want to be the CEO that lets the company go under or has a tanking stock price. So when you point out that these environmental issues are really about risk management, that's when you get a lot of people saying, oh, okay, I want to hedge that risk. What do I need to do? How do I avoid catastrophe? And so I think there's a lot of leadership happening in the grassroots, but also in boardrooms and on Wall Street happening mm-hmm. that could be tapped into and could be quite effective.
All right. We've run out of time. I'd like to thank both of you, Jonathan Foley, Director of the Institute on the Environment, the University of Minnesota in St. Paul, Catherine Hayhoe, Associate Professor, Director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University in Lubbock. Thank you both for taking time to be with us this hour.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.